Gary Parrish again from CBSSports.com. Again, it's now Monday, January 12th, 2015, and this is, of course, the Eye on College Basketball podcast, brought to you by Squarespace, which recently launched a version of its platform called Squarespace 7. It has a completely redesigned interface, integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps, 15 new templates, and a feature called Cover Pages. You want to try it? Go to squarespace.com and enter the offer code FUN at checkout to get 10% off. That's Squarespace. Start here, go anywhere. Okay, I'm joined today by Rob Doster from MDC Sports, and I want to start with the wild Sunday that we just witnessed. First, Duke lost at North Carolina State, then Wisconsin lost at Rutgers, then Arizona lost at Oregon State. All three losers were actually heavy favorites, all roughly double-digit favorites. I think Duke was around 9 or 10. So these were massive upsets. Rob, tell me, which result of those three surprised you the most?
Probably Arizona losing at Oregon State. You know, Wisconsin was playing without Frank Kaminsky, and then Trey Jackson got hurt late in the first half or at halftime. I don't think he played in the second half. So, you know, that one's – I know it's Rutgers, but that's understandable at least. And then NC State and Duke. Like, I feel like NC State every year has an upset like this in them. And, you know, to be honest with you, I feel like Mark Gottfried's team has kind of been – underperforming a little bit this season. If you look at the talent that he has on that roster, they should be, you know, either in the top 25 or close to the top 25. And winning at home against Duke, which is, you know, a rival, what are they, 25 miles away or something like that?
Yeah, it's close.
Yeah, they're going to give Duke a fight every single time at home. So, you know, Arizona losing at Oregon State was a little bit shocking to me. I didn't realize how good Oregon State has been playing this season. You know, I think Larry Krystkowiak at this point has to be the Pac-12 Coach of the Year. But, you know, you got to put Wayne Tinkle in the conversation. I mean, nobody had Oregon State doing anything this season. And I think they're, what, 11-4 now? They've won a couple Pac-12 games already. They're obviously going to, you know, be competitive anytime they play at home. So, I mean, you have to put him in the conversation there. He's really, really done a good job with them.
It's interesting you mentioned that you didn't notice how good Oregon State have been playing or how well Oregon State have been playing this year. I didn't either. Like yesterday, yeah, I do this thing, as you know, last call for drunk bets, where I had throw up a late game every night. And it's mostly unsuccessful, but it's still something I'm committed to doing. And so I noticed the line on Arizona. I think it opened at around 10, went down to 9 at one point. And I was like, really, Arizona over Oregon State? Because in my head, I'm like, that's Oregon State. That's like, this should be simple. And then I started looking at the numbers, like all the analytics of Oregon State, and they're not bad. You know, like I still picked Arizona because I'm committed to losing at this thing. But Oregon State isn't bad, and that's a testament to Wayne, because they shouldn't be good. They haven't been good in a while. That's why they had to get a new coach. And you look at that roster, and there's no reason for them to be competing with Arizona, and yet they knocked off Arizona. And this is Arizona's second really big questionable loss. Now, I know we're sitting here talking about how good Oregon State is, but it's, relatively speaking, not good enough to be banging heads with Arizona on a Sunday night. They've got the loss at UNLV a couple days before Christmas, now a loss at Oregon State. And in theory, I guess on one hand, this isn't a big deal. You know, it's still early. But, you know, the Arizona team last year wasn't taking losses like this early, and this one already has two. What do you make of that?
Well, I think they had them scouted perfectly. They played like a 2-3 zone that kind of looked like a matchup zone at times. And, you know, they sloughed off and they dared Arizona to try to shoot over the top. And, you know, if there's a knock on this Arizona team, is that they can't really score from the perimeter. You know, at times, T.J. McConnell is their best offensive option. And while I love T.J. and I think he's a really, really good point guard, it's not a good thing for Arizona if he is your best option on the offensive end of the floor. It's the same thing with Kansas, you know. Frank Mason has been really good this season, but if Frank Mason is their best offensive option and their best player this year, then, you know, Kansas is in trouble. So I think Arizona's, they're going to run into problems and they're going to lose games like this if T.J. McConnell is the guy that they're looking to for offense, especially down the stretch. And that's what happened. I mean, I don't know. Did you watch the game?
Yes.
Did you see the end of it?
Yes.
At the end of the game, they were playing Stanley Johnson and Rondae Hollis-Jefferson at the 4 or 5 because that's how bogged down their offense was. And I think that Oregon State kind of gave us a blueprint on, you know, what you have to do to beat Arizona. What's going to be interesting is to see, you know, I have all the respect in the world for Sean Miller when it comes to, you know, coaching a basketball team. And it's going to be interesting to see what he can do with this team to make an adjustment where they score a little bit more. Like last year when they lost Brandon Ashley, he got into more of like an up-tempo system and started pressing a little bit more because he had, you know, Rondé and Aaron Gordon and Nick Johnson, all these like absurd, ridiculous Olympic-level athletes, and just let them get out and run and make plays and do what they do in the open floor. And I don't think that he has the pieces to do that this season. So it's going to be interesting to see where he goes from here. And remember, Arizona on Saturday, I forget if they're at, I think they're, they get Utah at home. Yeah, they get Utah at home. And Utah might be the best team in the Pac-12 this season. I mean, I think they are in KenPom's ratings. So, you know, that's going to be a really, really interesting matchup. And frankly, if Arizona loses to Utah at home, I don't know if they can win the Pac-12 regular season title.
How about this? In the preseason, when I would have Matt Norlander on, Sam Vecenio on, my colleagues at CBS Sports.com, we were sort of going through the power conferences. It seemed, I don't know, pretty clear at that time that if you were trying to pick a power conference team that you could trust to win the championship, like who was, like win its own league championship, you know, Kentucky seemed like, yeah, they were the favorite, but they could maybe be threatened by Florida and also a preseason top 10 team. And Wisconsin was the favorite in the Big Ten, but, you know, Michigan was still there. Michigan State was still there. Nebraska was a preseason top 25 team. I think most people thought Arizona was, if you're trying to pick the most likely lock to win a league title, it might be Arizona. And you look up now, and I'm not even sure they're the best team in the Pac-12. Like Utah, by a bunch of different measuring devices, seems to be better right now.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to just how good Larry Krystkowiak has gotten this team. Like, to be honest with you, I think Arizona is just like maybe like a touch worse than we thought they were in the preseason. You know, they still can really, really get after you defensively. You know, they still have that big front line. They can still overpower you in the post at times. Like, they pretty much are who we thought they were. They're just having a little bit more issues scoring the ball than we expected. So I think this says a lot more about Utah and the job that Krystkowiak has done there than it does about Arizona and, you know, not living up to expectations or anything like that.
You know, so once upon a time, I think a lot of people were talking about how there was a pretty clear top tier of college basketball teams. There was like Kentucky and Duke and Arizona, etc. But in the past week, we've seen Kentucky being taken to overtime twice. Duke lost convincingly on the road. Arizona has now lost, like I said, at UNLV and at Oregon State. Is the gap between whatever teams we thought is it smaller than we thought, or is there even a gap at all? Like, I think we're like, oh, there's a top tier. I don't even know if there's a top tier anymore.
I still think there is. I still think that Duke and Kentucky, when push comes to shove, are the two best teams in the country. Maybe it's not as big of a gap as we expected, but, you know, Parrish, if there's anything that I've learned doing this job, it's that us, the guys that are supposed to be prognosticators, really have no idea what we're talking about.
That's sweet.
Like,
that's sweet.
We're making slightly more educated guesses than, you know, maybe someone that's a fan. But, like, if you look at what's going on right now, I mean, Duke lost at NC State. Arizona lost at Oregon State. Texas lost twice. They were number 10 in the country during this weekend. Kentucky's got taken to overtime twice. DePaul is tied for first place in the Big East. Like, what is going on in this sport?
You know what I think's more true is that we are now in a position to react publicly to everything in real time, that we end up muddying our own opinions. I actually try to stay away from this as much as possible, but I think you can ride a roller coaster and end up at the exact same spot you were at beforehand. It's a little bit like the Andrew Wiggins thing last year. If you would have just stayed committed at the very beginning, like Andrew Wiggins is the best freshman in the country. Andrew Wiggins is going to be great. If you'd have just stayed committed to that, you could have avoided all the questions throughout and then looked up at the end and said, see, I told you. And I wonder if that's a little bit like, that's an example, a small example, but an example of college basketball in general. Like you can spend this past week watching Kentucky go to overtime against Ole Miss and try to pick apart Kentucky and wonder how vulnerable they really are, and then watch them go to double overtime against Texas A&M and write down the five biggest issues facing Kentucky and put question marks beside a bunch of things. But if you just chill and let it all play out, we'll look up in March and Kentucky's still going to be Kentucky. Like you said, Duke's still going to be Duke, and so on and so forth. I wonder if these sort of twists and turns have always happened in college basketball, but we haven't always had Twitter and social media to react to them every single minute.
Yeah, and I think you're probably right about that. The other thing you got to remember is that now that we're in league play, you know, everybody is going to have everything that Kentucky and Arizona and Duke do. They're going to have it completely scouted out. They're going to have a game plan for everything that they've done. And, you know, the teams that haven't really struggled at this point in the season, like if you're undefeated, you're not changing all that much from what you do game to game. Like what you have done has worked. You know, Virginia's not going away from that pack line defense. Kentucky's not going to do anything different than what they've done all season long. And now you see teams figuring out what they're doing, game planning their offense or their defense to what they've done and what they see on film. So now, you know, you have Calipari and all these guys are going to be making their own adjustments. So it'll be fun to watch that. And the other thing is Duke and Kentucky and Arizona and even like Wisconsin, like when you host these teams, it is the biggest game of your season. You know, Texas A&M, like that's what they've been looking forward to since November, is that one shot that they get at Kentucky at home, and they're going to give it everything they have. And, you know, maybe for like Oregon, think about Arizona on a Sunday night. They've spent 4 days in the state of Oregon. They played at Oregon on Thursday, right? So they're up there for 4 days. They have nothing to do all day Sunday. Maybe they have this shoot around at what, like 11 a.m. Nothing to do all day Sunday except sit on a couch and watch a couple of football games, and you know, then they have to get up at 7 p.m. their time and go play a game against a team that is as fired up as they've been for a game all season long. Like, that's not an easy thing to do. And we're sitting here trying to make definitive statements on 19 and 20 and 21-year-old kids. And, you know, if I know anything about me when I was 19 or 20 or 21, or, you know, right now at 29, is that I'm not really all that reliable and all that consistent. And so I can't even imagine what it's like for these kids where they, you know, they almost are expected to win every single game. So I think that's a factor that you have to throw in as well.
We mentioned Wisconsin's loss at Rutgers earlier. You know, Duke lost at NC State. We've seen great Duke teams lose at NC State before. That really doesn't bother me that much. If anything, Mike will use it as some sort of teaching tool and they'll be fine. I agree with you. Duke's still going to be fine. Arizona's a little bit of a head scratcher, but whatever. I you know, the idea that if Sean Miller has a bad team, it'll be the first time in a long time, and he's not going to. I mean, that's going to be a top 10 team from now until the end. The other loss was the Wisconsin at Rutgers, and that one does come with a bit of an asterisk because Frank Kaminsky did not play. Who got hurt again?
Trey Jackson,
right, got hurt with an ankle. It was like a foot or an ankle, right? So, yeah. Like, they were shorthanded. But still, I will say this, because I got a lot of this last night on Twitter, you know, as I tweeted, you know, Wisconsin just lost at Rutgers. Like, 100 people wanted to tell me that Frank Kaminsky didn't play, as if I don't have the internet. Like, it's so funny to me. Like, this is my job, all right? I'm clearly on Twitter because, like, I just tweeted. The idea that you feel like you need to inform me that Frank Kaminsky didn't play, like I don't, like it's my goddamn job to know this type of stuff. Like, what do you, why do you feel like you have to tell me that? And so, like, people are like, oh, well, you know, Frank Kaminsky didn't play. I know Frank Kaminsky didn't play. Like, I was watching the game. I'm very aware. Either way, they were still like 15-point favorites even without Frank Kaminsky at Rutgers. And this is a Rutgers team that, you know, went, I think, 5-13.
They lost to St. Peter's,
right,
by 18 at home.
Right.
Like, that's all you need to know about this Rutgers team.
That was still a massive upset. Like, the idea, you know, without Frank Kaminsky, even limited by injury, that was still a massive upset to lose to Rutgers. Like, Wisconsin's going to be fine. Like, Bo Ryan's teams are always fine. But still, that was a pretty significant moment. Maybe not for Wisconsin, because whatever, they'll move on. But certainly for Rutgers, I mean, that's a memorable program moment.
Yeah, and the one thing I liked about that, and this is getting off topic a little bit. I don't know. At the very end, what they did with the fans, they held them off the court, and they didn't let them storm the floor until Wisconsin got off the court, which is something that I think, you know, I don't know if you remember last year. It was Utah Valley and New Mexico State. At the end of March,
first place
in the WAC, and Utah Valley fans stormed the floor while New Mexico State was still on the court, and you ended up getting a fight between the New Mexico State players and the Utah Valley fans. And, you know, remember what happened with Marcus Smart last year with the fans when they ran the court?
Sure.
I thought that it was really good of the Rutgers security staff that they were able to get the opposing team and the visiting team off the floor before they let the fans on there. And, you know,
they tried to do that with Duke NC State the other day, too. If you saw, like,
Coach but that K, didn't but didn't work.
Yeah, no, but they went and shook hands early. He was trying. K has been very aware of that. So yeah, like anything you can do to make that possible tough situation not so tough, I'm for that.
But it's hard when you have like 1,500 kids at each end just pushing on there, and like 10 old security guards and like yellow jackets sitting there trying to hold them back. Like, that's not going to work that well. But you know, I just, it was one thing that I noticed and something that I felt should get pointed out and applauded, because I think it's the way that we have to do it. I'm not against court storms, but it's just, that's a situation that it's kind of like a powder keg. You're just waiting for that spark and something really, really bad happens.
You know what? Like, people hit me with this the other day, because I was tweeting about, his name escapes me, I apologize, but the young man who was in a wheelchair and famously like stormed the court in his wheelchair when NC State beat Duke a few years ago. I was actually in Raleigh for that game. And so as it became clear NC State was going to win on Sunday, I sort of tweeted about him, and then he tweeted back at me. Like, he's like, I'm here, I'm ready to go. And, you know, I was tweeting as if I was excited about a court storm, and then people were reminding me how dangerous they can be. I didn't want it to come off like I contradict myself, because I publicly said before, like, I think court storming should be banned, because though it's very difficult to find examples of plenty of examples of serious injuries, although they do exist during court stormings. We can all see how some sort of problem can happen. Like, a student could hurt another student. A student could hurt a player. An opposing player could be agitated by students, and it could turn into a brawl. Like, there's a whole bunch of variables that could really lead to something bad. So I'm with you fundamentally against court stormings. I think they should be banned. But if we're gonna have them, I like to see the guy in the wheelchair involved. That was my only point.
Yeah, and I don't know. See, it's part of, like, the game. You don't really see that it doesn't happen in the NBA. It doesn't happen in really any other sport except maybe college football. So I like the tradition of it, and I think that for the most part, like, most fans are good people. Like, they're just looking out there to have fun. If you're, like, a 20-year-old college kid, you're not running on the floor to try to fight some 6'8" power forward that weighs 245 pounds and could bench you 28 times.
Now, I'd fight point guard way before I'd fight a power forward.
Like, you're not, that's not what you're trying to do, though. You're not trying to start a fight. You're just going out there to try to jump around and maybe get on TV and maybe, like, photobomb the interview with your coach on ESPN. Like, that's what you want to do. Get a selfie when you're, like, in the middle of whatever NC State's court is. That's what you want to do. It's just, it's the issue of, you know, if you're mad when you lose. Any athlete is going to be mad when they lose. And if they run into a fan and the wrong thing happens, like, if one punch is thrown, like, that could turn into a full-out brawl and turn into a really, really ugly scene. And I think the biggest thing is try to avoid that. You know, let's do something where that never happens and we never get to a point where we say, all right, now we have to change it because this happened. Don't let it happen in the first place.
I know. Like, I agree 100%. And I do think this, if we continue to allow court stormings, like, the SEC has banned them. Like, you know, like, you have to pay a hefty fine, relatively speaking, but a hefty fine if your students storm the court. And so there's an incentive for university security to prevent it, not just try to make it as safe as possible, but actually prevent it. Now, it still happens. Like, you know, Ole Miss stormed the football field after it beat Alabama. And I was in Nashville many years ago when Vanderbilt fans stormed the court after they upset Florida. I think it was Billy's second national championship team. And so they still happen, but they're very rare in the SEC. And I think that's more right than wrong, because we can talk about, you know, it's part of the game and it's tradition and it makes for great television. And all of that is undeniably true. But I will say that if you continue to let these things happen, and I don't want to come off as like some fuddy-duddy, but like, anybody who knows me knows that I'm the opposite of that. But if you continue to let these things happen, there will be a fight sometime. And not just one that involves, you know, two teams that nobody cares about. Like, there will be a high-profile, you know, punches thrown between student, opposing player, or something. And then that, you know, why wait for that to do something about this? Like, if you know that's going to happen sooner or later, and I'm confident that will happen sooner or later, if I were running a league, we would be putting in some sort of something to try to ensure not only that doesn't happen, but that court stormings in general do not happen. Because I do think it's a bad situation waiting to happen. We've had bad moments before. Nothing seriously high profile, but it'll get there at some point. Meantime, Virginia won at Notre Dame on Saturday. Came back, just a fun game. Lots of shot making. The Cavaliers have now won at VCU, at Maryland, and at Notre Dame. Nobody has anywhere close to as quality of road wins as those three wins. Make sense of this. Has Tony Bennett replaced Brad Stevens as the wizard of college hoops? You did a really nice thing on the pack line defense that they run a few weeks ago, and it is just remarkable to watch them play on that end of the court, and they're also really efficient on the offensive end of the court, and there's nothing on that roster that suggests they ought to be operating at this level, but they are, and they're doing it for the second straight year. Yeah, how much of this is just Tony Bennett's awesome at what he does?
I think it's all Tony Bennett is awesome at what he does, and I think that Brad Stevens is the wrong comparison for him. I would more liken him to Bo Ryan than Brad Stevens, because what I think Tony does so well is go out and target the guys that he knows is going to fit into what he wants to do. And you know, I think you wrote about this, right? Where Virginia doesn't have a McDonald's All-American. They don't even have like a consensus top 50 recruit.
Nope.
And if James
Justin Anderson.
Yeah, if Justin Anderson, I think he's going to end up being a pro. Like, he's a perfect prototype 3-and-D guy. But if he doesn't end up being a first-round pick or even an NBA draft pick, like, they don't have a guy on that team that's going to end up being an NBA player. So what he's able to do with them and drill into them defensively, and that's the biggest thing, is, like, everybody on that team buys in. They're not so much worried about their stats. They're not worried about, you know, whether or not they're going to get 15 shots a game. All they want to do is go out there and win.
Right.
And so he goes out there and he targets guys that he knows are going to play their asses off defensively, are going to share the ball on the offensive end, and, you know, are just going to buy into this team Virginia concept. And I think that's exactly what Bo Ryan has done at Wisconsin, is where he doesn't care about recruiting rankings or how good you're going to be in the future. He wants guys that fit into his system and what he does. And I think that when you can target those guys on the recruiting trail, like, that's the hardest thing for a coach to do, is to find a guy that fits into what he wants to do and is going to believe in him as a coach. And I think, you know, Tony Bennett has kind of mastered that art at this point.
Yeah, the only reason I brought up Stevens was not anything sort of style, but just, like, once upon a time, Brad Stevens was sort of labeled as, God, nobody does it better than this guy, you know, which is why he got the Boston Celtics job, frankly. And it's starting to look like, you know, Tony Bennett is that type of guy. And I spent a long time on the phone with Tony a couple weeks ago for that column you mentioned. And I was just struck by sort of his approach to everything. We were sort of chatting about, I told him that, you know, Virginia fans were constantly hitting me up about how they don't get enough attention and people don't talk about them enough. And he was like, really? And he was like, really? Like, they do that? And I was like, yeah, like, they think you guys deserve more than you get. And he was like, oh, I actually think we get too much attention. He's like, you know, we're always in the newspaper and we're always like, you know, what else do we want? And they were getting ready to play Davidson. And I thought this was interesting because as I was dealing with, and I say dealing with, I wasn't really dealing with anything, but Virginia fans had been tweeting me nonstop, like, you need to write about us, you need to talk about us. And so as I'm sort of dealing with that on one end, I'm talking to Tony, like, maybe the day before the Davidson game, and I just didn't know because I had not looked yet. I was like, so are you guys on TV tomorrow night? And he said, I don't know. I think maybe, but I'm not sure. And I went and looked it up. They were on ESPNU. My point being, he had no idea if they were even playing on national television. Like, he does not, like, so, like, some coaches say they don't care about, I don't care people talking about us. I don't care if, you know, we're on TV. I'm just trying to do my job. And yet, that was just a moment where it wasn't just a guy saying, I'm only concerned with doing my job well. I don't care about any of the other stuff. It was a moment where he proved it unintentionally. He genuinely had no idea if the game they were playing in 24 hours was going to be on national television or not. And I just think that, like, he's really created this culture of, and so when your head coach doesn't care about anything, it can sort of trickle down to the players don't care about anything other than let's get better today and win tomorrow. And I don't know if anybody, you know, with all due respect to Bo Ryan and whoever else, I don't know if anybody has a better culture of that right now than Tony does at Virginia.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I remember Virginia was playing at Barclays for, I think it was a Barclays Center Classic, wherever one of those preseason game was. And I was talking to talking to Justin Anderson just about, you know, my biggest concern entering the season with Virginia was that they didn't have like a go-to guy offensively. They didn't have someone where defense had to pay attention to him. Last year they had Joe Harris, and you know, they could run Joe Harris off of screens, and defenses had to know where he was at all times. And, you know, what Justin told me, like, Joe had a bad senior season, well, quote-unquote bad. Like, his scoring went down from 16 to 12 points. And what Justin was telling me is that Tony basically used him as a decoy all season long. He would run him off these screens knowing that he would get two or three defenders paying attention to him, and that would open stuff up for everybody else. And Joe was perfectly fine with that. He was like, yeah, cool, let's do it. We're going to win more games this way. And they ended up winning the ACC. And that, like, he said that's what this team is kind of built on, is the idea of it doesn't matter who gets the shots or who gets the points, as long as at the end of the day we have more points than the other team. And this, maybe it's just us that'll find this interesting, but I just looked them up on KenPom, the Virginia KenPom page, and they're predicted to win every single game the rest of the season, which includes at North Carolina, a sweep of Louisville, and against Duke. And I mean, I think that kind of tells you where this team is right now. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think the only teams currently projected by KenPom to still, you know, be favored in every game they play, Kentucky, Virginia, and Gonzaga. I think that's it. And, you know, Gonzaga is league-related, although I think Gonzaga is terrific. But I don't think Virginia is going to run the table in the ACC. But the idea that a statistical analysis could project you that way on January 12th is it's pretty impressive. Remember, today's Eye on College Basketball podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, where you can easily create your own professional website or online portfolio. Squarespace is now redesigned with Squarespace 7 interface, including integration with Google Apps, partnership with Getty Images, 15 new templates and cover pages, and it has an amazing support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Everything starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content's going to look great on every device every time. To start a free trial, and no credit card required, get to building your website today. When you decide to sign up, make sure to use the offer code FUN at squarespace.com. Offer code FUN to get 10% off and to show your support for the Eye on College Basketball podcast. That's Squarespace. Start here. Go anywhere. All right, let's do some news and notes presented by Squarespace. And one thing I wanted to touch on is that there were some big shots this weekend for a couple of guards who had kind of been, if not absolutely been, struggling this season. One for Marcus Page, the other for Marcus Foster. Is Page hits a floater to beat Louisville on Saturday afternoon, and then Marcus Foster, you know, hits the shot that forces overtime that leads to Kansas State upsetting Oklahoma. Both those guys out of whatever funk they were in, and specifically with Kansas State, I think it was reasonable, at least before Saturday, to call them the biggest disappointment in college basketball. Did they figure something out, or was that just sort of one game and they'll get back to being what they were?
I think that the bench taught Marcus Foster a pretty significant lesson. I don't know if you saw the Oklahoma State game, but he got benched because of whatever. Like, you talk to 10 different people, they give you 10 different reasons of what's going on there. Basically, he wasn't happy in his role. Like, he wanted more shots. I think he wanted to be more of a point guard because he got in his head that that's what he wants to be at the next level. Whatever the case was, he was just not playing the way that Bruce Weber expected him to be. So he benched him against Oklahoma State. He played 14 minutes. He didn't score. Kansas State lost by 14. They were 7-7. Like, it looked really, really bad. And he was on the bench. And, you know, I'm not going to repeat it because I'd probably get fired, and you get fired at the end of the podcast, and nobody wants that. But you could tell when they zoomed in on him and you read his lips, he was not happy with Bruce Weber leaving him on the bench. But I think he also got the point, because when you come back after a game like that and you realize that you were on national TV, like, cussing out your coach, people can read your lips, like, that's kind of a humbling experience. And no NBA team, if his goals get to the NBA, no NBA team wants a kid that's going to sulk on the bench. So Bruce Weber said that Monday and that Tuesday were the two best days of practice that Foster has had all year. He came back, came off the bench, and had 23 in a win over TCU, and then against Oklahoma. He didn't get down when he got in foul trouble. He actually hit the game-winning shot at the end of overtime as well. And I think that what you're seeing now is that he's kind of woken up a little bit, and he's kind of gotten the point. And if he's getting the point, he's playing like a guy that could be an All-American, then I think that Kansas State is good enough to finish in the top half of the Big 12. Because, I mean, they are. you know, they are good enough to do that. So it'll be interesting to see if this continues. And you know, I think they're going to be a really interesting game. Let's say they finish, you know, 11-7 or 10-8 in the Big 12, and they, you know, they beat everyone they should beat at home. They get an upset win here or there. What do you do with them come NCAA tournament time? Because they really have a bad non-conference
record. I think they did so much damage to themselves in the non-conference. I mean, they lost to Long Beach State. They lost to
Texas Southern at home.
Texas Southern at home. Really, those are the only two, like, bad. But, well, I mean, Tennessee, that's probably not a good, you know, especially considering Alabama
Pitt,
just
Pitt's
ran.
Pitt's not a good loss. Yeah. Lost by 23 to Pitt.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they really did some serious damage to themselves in the non-conference. I mean, they'd have to finish, I don't know. I mean, they'd have to go over and above on in the league to even put themselves in consideration for.
Well, if they finish 10-8 in the league, they're going to have 14 losses on the season.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That's a lot of losses.
And some bad ones. Some really bad ones.
Especially when Texas Southern is one of those losses.
Yeah, if I were a betting man, and I am a betting man, I would bet against them being in the NCAA tournament.
Not a very good one.
Not lately. Certainly not. Yeah,
what's your record in that right now, by the way?
19-21-3.
So you haven't lost that much money.
No, well, I mean, if you confine it just to late night drunk bets, but when you start including my early day sober bets and like, you know, sort of like early evening drunk bets, it gets lopsided. The bowl season was bad for me. 12 gauge cost me a lot of money.
That's why I stay away from gambling because I'm awful at it. Like, I try to help my buddies make picks, and you know, I'm just. There was one stretch where I think I lost like 11 in a row, and my friend was like, "Yeah, I kept asking you for real picks, and then I would literally just bet against whatever you said, and I started making money."
Yeah, no. What you'll find out is most gamblers are bad at it, but that doesn't stop them. And so, yeah, what are you gonna do? Hey, Georgia Tech lost to Wake Forest over the weekend, which like probably didn't even register for most people, but. It did drop Georgia Tech to 0-3 in the ACC. Among the on-the-hot-seat power conference guys, Brian Gregory is probably the most up against it now. He's in his fourth season. He's never not lost twice as many ACC games as he's won. Never finished better than ninth in the league. If this goes the way it looks like it's going right now, do you think he's going to get a fifth year at Georgia Tech?
Man, I'm so bad at predicting these things, but you know, it just doesn't feel like there's any momentum in that program.
That's the problem.
You know, like, you can have a bad team if you've gone out and you've got some good recruits coming in. Like, look, what Billy Kennedy's doing at Texas A&M now, I think, is a good comparison. Like, that Texas A&M team probably isn't going to be all that good this year. They're probably not going to make the NCAA tournament. They're probably not, you know, if they had beaten Kentucky, that might be the highlight of his tenure so far. What is it, 4 years at Texas A&M? But he's got like all these good recruits coming in next season, and he landed a couple good recruits for the 2014 class, and you know, he's starting to make some headway in the state of Texas. And so I don't think you can get rid of him yet because, you know, the future looks really bright. Like, what looks bright about Georgia Tech right now?
That's exactly the problem. I was talking with somebody about this over the weekend, and you know, they asked me about Gregory, and I said, you know, like the problem becomes like, you know, if you're the administration, it's not just that this year is going poorly or the first 3 years have gone poorly, but it's like, why would next year be any different? You know, is there any sort of tangible sign that suggests next year is going to be better? And, I like Brian, and I hate having these conversations about guys because it's their jobs. I wouldn't want, you know, two idiots on a podcast somewhere talking about my jobs. And so I don't enjoy these conversations at all, but like, if you look at it honestly and you go, okay, this, you know, exactly like what you said about Texas A&M. Okay, so the Billy Kennedy thing hasn't really gone well, and this season's probably not going to go too well either. But, okay, so then you ask, but is next year going to be better? And you can start, you could go, yeah, I could, like, he's enrolling a top 10 recruiting class. There's at least some reason to believe in the future of Billy Kennedy at Texas A&M. I just wonder if there's reasons to believe in the future of Brian Gregory at Georgia Tech. And if somebody asked me to answer that honestly, I don't know. I mean, I don't see it. I mean, there's no it's not like there's these awesome transfers sitting out or these awesome recruits on the way. It does seem, I think you used the right word, it's a program that seems to lack momentum right now.
Yeah, the interesting one to me, I forget who made the point. It might have been you that made this point that, you know, everyone that we kind of said was on the hot seat entering the season
I did
had a really good start to the year. What about Steve Lavin now?
Yeah,
They've lost three in a row to start Big East play. Like, Rashid Jordan, who knows what's going on with him.
Right.
They don't have any depth up front. They landed a recruit today, a top 50 kid.
Right.
But it's not like that one top 50 kid is going to be able to change the fact that they're losing, you know, four seniors and might lose Chris Obekpa and Rashid Jordan to the NBA. He didn't get Isaiah Briscoe. He's still in the mix for Sheck Diallo, but who knows if he's going to end up getting him. I think Kansas and Kentucky both want him too. So what about Steve Lavin?
Well, they're still sitting here at 11-4, on January 12th. So that's not awful. And three of the losses are to currently ranked teams, like Gonzaga, single-digit loss, Seton Hall, a loss on the road, and then a loss to Villanova. That was, I guess, last Tuesday. And then the other loss is a Butler loss, right, by 4 points. So there really is no bad losses. I think it's four top 30 KenPom losses. And then they've got wins over Minnesota, got a win over Syracuse, got a blowout win up a Tulane team that isn't bad. I mean, isn't good, but isn't bad. So though the 0-3 Big East start is concerning, particularly when two of those games are home games, one's a loss on the road to a ranked team, and the other and another is a loss at home to the team that's probably going to win the league. So I'm not that concerned with St. John's right now. I still think that they have an opportunity to turn this around, be fun, and actually make the NCAA tournament. But clearly, when you start 11-1, you don't ever want to be 11-4, right? That's not, you know, there's no sense in arguing.
It's not ideal.
Yeah, if you're 11-1, you don't want to look up 2 weeks later and be 11-4. But I would guess they'll do enough, and Steve, for a variety of reasons, we'll probably be okay. But it is interesting, like, the guys that we thought might be on the hot seat, and still could be. It's very, very early. These things can turn in a variety of ways. But, you know, Kevin Willard, Travis Ford, Tom Crean, so far, so good. Last thing I wanted to talk to you about, it was a headline from late last week, and I don't know if it got a lot of national attention, because it sort of seemed like an old story to some people. But I know it's something you and I have both written about in the summer. And that's that, the three Oregon basketball players were accused of sexual assault toward the end of last season. And we found out about it in the off season, and it made for this weird sort of admission by Oregon officials where, because for people who don't understand the timeline, this happened just before the Pac-12 tournament. Then the three accused players, only two of them were actually a part of the team, actively a part of the team. Brandon Austin was sitting out. And Dana Altman had said he knew his players were accused of something, but didn't know which players and didn't know what. Said he never knew Brandon Austin was accused of sexual assault while at Providence. Said, and then we find out that the president actually did know what the players were accused of. So we're operating, if you just take their story at face value, and you shouldn't, you take their story at face value, it's like the president knew, but the basketball coach didn't. It's like none of it made sense, right? And I think you pointed this out. I know I pointed it out. And I essentially, I think I used a kinder word, but I said Dana Altman's lying here. He has to be lying, or else he was recklessly irresponsible in running his basketball program. One of the two. He's either lying or he's recklessly irresponsible. And so I say all that to say the young woman, the alleged victim or the accuser, filed a lawsuit against both Oregon and Dana Altman last week, alleging all sorts of things. In simple terms, that everybody is lying. That if you say you didn't know Brandon Austin was accused of sexual assault at Providence, you're lying. If you say you didn't know what players were involved before you played them in the Pac-12 tournament and the NCAA tournament, that's not the truth. Is this going to ultimately cost Dana Altman his job? The really accomplished and quality columnist at the Oregonian, John Canzano, wrote that Dana Altman should be fired and that for every day that he's still employed is a bad day for Oregon. I don't know that he's going to survive this. Do you think Dana Altman's going to survive this?
No, and I wrote that he should be fired back in May or June or whenever, when all this stuff first kind of came out.
Right.
And I think the most damning piece of evidence against him is that in that lawsuit that was filed, Brandon Austin's mom actually told the lawyer's investigator that she had told Oregon everything.
Right.
That Oregon knew everything that he was accused of. They knew why he was suspended. They knew why he was kicked out of school. They knew everything about the situation with Brandon Austin at Providence, which is the truth. And I don't even think that – look, I flat out don't buy that Dana Altman had no idea what was going on, because I was having conversations about Brandon Austin and that sexual assault allegation at Providence in, like, November.
Sure.
And, like, I don't talk to that many important people, but a lot of people that I knew about this. I'm sure a lot of people that you knew about this.
Of course.
And it was to the point where the first time it was ever written publicly was in March. And I remember that story from I think it was, like, March 19th. And I remember the date because when it was published in the Wall Street Journal, I was like, whoa, like, this isn't common knowledge. People don't know about this yet. That's how many conversations I had about it. And if I knew about it, then either Dana Altman, one, completely ignored the fact that, you know, this kid was kicked out of school for something that was obviously pretty serious, or two, just, you know, overlooked the fact that he was bringing the kid into his program that was accused of a sexual assault. And, you know, the one thing that has kind of been brought up is that Brandon Austin was placed there like it was a Nike thing.
Sure.
Oregon is Nike school. He came up a Nike kid. So that doesn't look better for Altman either. So either he's just like a complete pawn in this program and has absolutely no teeth and no say in what's going on there, which, you know, is not ideal for the coach of a program, or he's a guy that doesn't own up to the fact that he brought a kid that was accused of sexual assault onto the campus and then that kid committed another sexual assault. Like, I understand giving someone a second chance. Like, Austin was never officially charged. I don't think he was convicted of anything. So I understand giving a kid a second chance. But if you bring him onto your campus and he does the exact same thing that he was accused of and kicked out of another school for, like, you have to own up to that. You have to face the music for that. And, you know, that's my biggest issue, is that he's not taking ownership of the fact that he brought in a kid that could be, you know, like a serial sexual predator onto his campus. And, you know, this thing is, it's so murky because sexual assault issues, like, it's really, really hard because the only people that actually know what happened are the accuser and the three people she accused. And it's always going to be a he said, she said kind of thing. Like, they have different stories. So who really knows what actually happens? My issue is that he brought a kid that was accused of sexual assault onto his campus. That kid is accused of another sexual assault, and then he lied about whether or not he knew what was going on. And to me, that is a fireable offense.
Yeah, to me, this is very simple. You either knew and you're lying now, which is awful, or you didn't know when I knew and you knew and everybody and lots of people in basketball knew, which is recklessly irresponsible. So, like, you pick. I don't care. Like, okay, you can pick A or B. Those are the only options here. A is you knew and now you're lying. That's awful. That's fireable. B is you didn't know, but you should have. That's also awful. So, like, I'll let you pick, but you got to pick one of those two. And the other part of the story that just flew in the face of common sense was the idea that Dana Altman was told three of his players, two of whom were a part of his team that was competing in the Pac-12 tournament and NCAA tournament, were accused of something very serious, and yet he didn't know which players and he didn't know what it was. That's the story. That was the initial story, at least. Are you out of your mind? Like, in what I've talked to a dozen college basketball coaches about this, and all of them, like, and I'm not even talking about people who hate Dana Altman or people who have an axe to grind. People, they're just like, come on, man. Like, if college basketball coaches, and this is sort of the column I wrote back in, you know, again, early off season, they often talk about themselves as, you know, as their players, as, hey, these are my sons, we're a family. And so I just try to, like, I have an 11-year-old, and I can imagine the cops knocking on my door. This is essentially what Dana Altman said happened. The cops knock on my door, and they say, let's say I had four kids, right? And they say, hey, Gary, we just want to let you know one of your kids has been accused of something very, very serious, but we cannot tell you which one and we cannot tell you what it is. But so just chill and we'll let you know when we know. We'll let you know when we can tell you more. Are you – and you think I'd just say –
like, you're okay? Not going to figure it out? Like, you're not going to –
Or like I would just say, okay. First off, I'd be like, no, you ain't going to do that. Like, you're going to tell me what's going on with my son. Or, like, I had multiple coaches tell me this. what you do, if the cops won't tell you, and keep in mind, the cops would tell you, all right? You're the head basketball coach at a public university. If you said what players did what, if you genuinely wanted to know, they would tell you, all right? So that just doesn't fly in the face of anything. Athletic departments and police staff, police officers have like a pretty, I don't want to say tight relation, but they know each other because they have to. And so the idea that you couldn't find out is just crazy. But even if the cops were like as tight-lipped as ever and they weren't going to tell you, the first thing you do is gather your players in the locker room and you sit everybody down and you say, hey, listen, something went on this weekend. Some of you are in trouble. Somebody speak up. Somebody tell me what's going on. We're not leaving here until we do. You'd figure it out if you wanted to figure out. So again, he either is lying that he didn't know, which I think is more likely than not, or B, he didn't do anything to try to find out, which I think is negligent. And when you combine that with the fact that he and his staff actually got bonuses for making the NCAA tournament and all of those things, then you really put coaches in a position where they are financially benefiting from not knowing so that they can continue to play players that could theoretically help them win games. And the whole thing is just a mess. Again, I can't tell you for sure that anybody's lying, although Brandon Austin's mom seems to think that Dana Altman is lying. But I can tell you for sure one of these two things. They either lied during that press conference or they were recklessly irresponsible in how they handled the entire situation dating back to enrolling Brandon Austin. And to me, in this climate of how athletics is treating sexual assault and domestic violence, it's unacceptable.
Not even just that. Like in a decent society,
just
of
a decent
people,
dude.
Yeah.
Right.
Like if you're going to be a decent person, if you're going to be in charge of like the lives of young people, like you should be fired for, you know, either being negligent or lying about, you know, the risks that you were putting this campus at. So I absolutely agree with you that Dana Altman should be fired for this.
I would imagine that when we start the 2015-16 season, for one reason or another, he will not be the coach at Oregon. We'll see. Okay, well, listen, I've kept Rob here long enough, kept you guys here long enough, so let's get out of here, but not before I thank everybody for listening. You're kind to do that. Remember, you can subscribe to the Ion College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. It's the quickest way to get your hands on the latest podcast, so make sure to do that, and either way, we will talk again later on this week. Take care.